I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me are my colleagues today, Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. This is the date and time set for oral argument in case number 87698 in the matter of Fisher versus Wing. At council table, I believe we have Bradley Schrager for appellant cross respondent, Stephen Fisher and Deborah Ammons for respondent cross appellant Beatrice Wing. Ms. Ammons, can you identify who's with you at council table?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Each party will be limited to 15 minutes of argument, but because this is a cross appeal, both sides may reserve time for rebuttal. And if necessary, the court may be willing to give some extra time. We'll see how it goes. Mr. Schrager, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
Your Honor, at this time, I'm going to shoot for 4 minutes on rebuttal, but as you say, story of my life, best laid plans. We'll see how it goes.
Okay. And Ms. Ammons, how much time would you like to reserve?
Yes, I have written down 3 minutes. I may need more.
Very good. Well, we're now ready to proceed. Mr. Schrager, you may take the podium.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, and good afternoon. I am Bradley Schrager of the law firm of Bravo Schrager, representing Mr. Fisher. I was appointed counsel in a case that, as you can tell, has a rather hairy and lengthy record, both the record on appeal and the appendix, and is, look, these are not people of enormous means. These are not young adults with years and years of working life ahead of them, but that does not mean, and this is why I appreciate the court hearing this oral argument, that does not mean that they do not deserve the full attention and consideration and fairness of the law. Now, district court judges, especially in the rurals, have to be jacks of all trades of every single type of law. I understand that. I myself am not trained as a family lawyer. I've learned a lot during this case. But even in areas where the district court judges may not be experts, they still have an obligation to follow the lights of the law and to get it right. And in this particular case, there are a number of issues with the district court's order that argue for correction and potentially remand. Now, I have always learned that it is easier to appeal a case where there's one big flashing thing wrong, as opposed to multiple things that maybe medium or small size that are wrong. This case has both of those, but I'm gonna try and focus on the big ticket items for a very particular purpose. Nevada is not a cumulative error state. But in matters of probate or dividing a marital estate, you're talking about a web in which if you touch it in one place, it reverberates elsewhere. Right? Valuations of an estate will affect other valuations as the court is striving to get it right when dividing the estate. But a court cannot act equitably or divide equally, which is the charge under law, unless it has the full picture correct at the outset. So failing that, the web will have too many holes and the spider won't be able to eat, get dinner. The district court here failed to do that. And they had essentially devastating consequences for Mr. Fisher. So I want to start with what I think is probably one of the biggest tickets and one of the most glaring errors, which has to do with the designation of separate versus community property. Because the biggest ticket item in this estate, apart from the marital residence, was Mr. Fisher's New York Life IRA account ending 2955. At the time of the decree, it was valued at $105,000. There's evidence in the record admitted by the district court that this account with $105,000 in it was opened and maintained prior to marriage. Nevada law is fairly clear. What you come to when you are married is your separate property. It remains your separate property until it loses that identity, and it loses that identity in a variety of ways, commingling, for example.
Okay, Mr. Schrager, I want to ask you a little bit about that particular
account.
And I want to clarify, your argument on this point is basically a sufficiency of the evidence argument, correct? That there was insufficient evidence presented during the trial that this was commingled and that it became community property.
That would be part of the argument. The argument is that the finding that it's community property must itself be supported by substantial evidence.
Okay, and so my question for you is, what do we do about Ms. Wing's testimony that the premarital contribution was $29,000 and that both parties made $303 a month payments throughout the marriage? Why wouldn't that testimony suffice as evidence of the community property nature of that property?
It would if it had to do with this account. Because when I saw the $303 figure, I too said, well, where's that coming from? Because in the actual, on pages of 1232 to 1238 of the record, which has the sort of status and of this particular account, account 2955, there's no record of any deposits whatsoever, especially not over time. So I hunted down in the record where the $303 came from. And at record page 1474, there's a premium payment option that just happens to be exactly $303 for a completely separate account. So it is entirely likely that Ms. Wing is mistaken, and that therefore the sufficient evidence ought not to have been credited because it didn't have its account.
So, and then my next question is, aren't you essentially asking us as the appellate court to make a credibility call and to look at the testimony, the bare, you know, transcript, and say she was wrong, he was right?
Well, it matters who was right, right? I mean, if the documentary evidence, and clearly you understand, my client was representing himself pro se, right? Now, I'm not saying that there's extra leeway built into that, but there should be an understanding of the sophistication of the advocates as well. So if the record itself, put before the judge, demonstrates that there is not sufficient evidence to make a finding that all of that, the $105,000, was in fact community property, it shouldn't hold. And the fact is, even if there was commingling, Nevada law clearly says, if you can trace the separate property within the commingle, or the sort of body of the funds, you should make an effort to do so. But
Mr. Schrager, let me interrupt you for a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you suggesting that with this particular item, the IRA, that we should extend MomQuest or some sort of calculation if there is commingling of funds? I'm really not certain whether there was. And Mr. Fisher didn't really provide any information at the time of the hearing below to suggest that there was no additional monies contributed. Or was it just a rollover IRA? Were there any monies contributed during the time of the marriage?
During the marriage, not to my knowledge. And there's certainly no record of it. And that was his testimony, was that there were certainly no community funds. But there is admitted evidence in the record at 1233 and 1234 that no monies at all were put into it after the marriage. So this would be entirely separate a property that should have been credited to him. Now, there's certainly nothing in the district court's order and his findings to resolve the question. The district court simply includes that account in the community property without comment, without findings, without anything. Simply says, this is community property. That's problematic.
So what are you asking this court to do with respect to that asset?
It depends on what the court will do generally. It seems to me that the cumulative problems in the order and in the record demonstrate that the picture, the accounting of the entire estate, cannot be appropriate, cannot be made. But it would be it would certainly be appropriate on this record to say that the district court simply got that wrong, and that is not community property, that's a separate property, and vacate that portion of the order. Because my client, in the end, lost $52,500 of credit in the estate, which also would have affected the rest of the estate. This error throws off the entire balancing act of the district court's division of assets.
And Schrager, take Chief Judge Bullough's question and apply it to the life insurance policies and accept that testimony that Judge Westbrook was referring to, that payments have been made during the course of the marriage? How do you characterize the life insurance? What is the community entitled to?
As you see in our briefing, the majority of our argument regarding the distribution of property dealt with this IRA, because the record seems fairly clear that there was no community funds contributed to that. If, in fact, there were community funds placed into life insurance, and the plaintiff, the respondent here, or the respondent here was the beneficiary, that would argue for an inclusion of that in the community property column. And in fact, that's what the district court did. I don't think we have a tremendous problem with that. The problem is with the other.
Are you talking about the portions that were paid during the marriage? Just do what with them? Do divide them in half or use a Momquist approach where you have to determine valuations and increase in value and all of that, as opposed to what the district court apparently did, was just say it was community property and divide it 50-50.
Mr. Schrager, let me ask this question. Are the life insurance policies even at issue on this appeal? Is the concern the IRA?
Mainly. There is one life insurance policy that comes back around when we get to the marital waste question. But the life insurance policies generally are not complained of here.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, that's good to know. On something completely different, I have to ask you this, and I know your time is running short, so I'll keep it really fast.
Yeah.
You know, the respondent claims that the attorney fees that were paid towards the criminal defense counsel, that Mr. Fisher agreed that Ms. Wing should not have to pay any of that, and he should be 100% responsible for those fees. Is that accurate? Did he say that during the proceedings below?
I believe he did say that during the proceedings.
Yet you're still challenging that on appeal?
As a legal point, it was not waste to have spent that money.
Right. So that's a difficult legal issue to resolve. But if we don't have to go there on that point,
what about the
civil lawyer?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Let's sort of talk about marital waste generally, because that's sort of where you're leading here. And the marital waste is not a huge number here, but it's exceptionally important because it reduces the flat dollar amount of the lien, which is itself improper, which I'd like to get to under Momquist, if I could, in a moment. But, you know, let's the civil attorney fees that were charged to my client as marital waste for his divorce attorney, and the sort of district court says in parentheses, could be seen as selfish. Let's recall, and this sort of leads us into a weird cul-de-sac, he was the defendant in a divorce action. He had to try and find an attorney. Where was that money going to come from? I mean, according to the district court, he had nothing but community funds. So
you're correct and it's not waste.
Yeah.
Can't the district court order it anyway because of the general power it has under the statute it's cited to award attorney fees?
Yes. That would be a different avenue to do that. And in fact, that actually gives the lie to the whole thing, because obviously my client was also ordered to pay the respondent's attorney's fees. And of course, where did the district court think that was coming from, if not from community funds, because that's all the two of them had at that time, right? So the idea that spending money for your attorney in the divorce action you were served with is marital waste is simply legal error and throws off the entire calculation. Now, the same thing could be said regarding one of the New York Life insurance accounts that Mr. Fisher claims is his separate property. Now, one of the issues with that is he was penalized for that regarding the amount of the lien because it purportedly violated the financial restraining order. Now, if in fact that was his separate property, as he contends was error here below, obviously that shouldn't have been taken off of his lien amount. He may have, in fact, theoretically violated the financial restraining order, and the judge could have been cross about that. He would not have wasted marital assets, right? Even violating the financial temporary restraining order doesn't transform those funds into community funds. They remain, if they ever were, his separate funds. I'm not saying he could do whatever he wanted with them, but there would have been an order to show cause and a discussion of the appropriate penalty and no damage to the estate.
What about alimony? Both counsels seem to believe that the court ordered $1,200 a month for 5 years. That's the way the briefing reads, but the amended decree says for 6 months. So you're appealing saying there should have been no alimony. The other side's appealing saying there should have been more. It should be for the full 5 years. So do you agree that it should be sent back to the district court?
Clearly, there are discrepancies within the order. This isn't the only one. There are discrepancies within the order that lead to confusion and a difficulty of enforcement. You're pointing at one of them, and that's exactly right, and my colleague can speak to it as well.
Are you suggesting to the court that alimony should not have been $1,200 a month for 5 years?
You know, alimony is within the sound discretion of the court and should be calculated based on a clear vision and a good picture of the estate and the condition of the parties. My generalized argument is that didn't exist because of the errors I pointed out, still doesn't exist, and so alimony should be recalculated, if it's to exist at all, based on a clear and appropriate picture of the conditions of the parties as they come before him.
It seems like the problem with the alimony calculation, though, isn't the amount per month. It was either 5 years or 6 months. So I'm not sure that that's the type of error that you're referring to.
No, I would claim that if you don't have an appropriate picture of the entire estate, you cannot divide things equally or award alimony in an appropriate amount. And so it should be recalculated on that basis. I just have a few seconds left. I absolutely want to make this point having to do with the major asset in the estate, and that's the marital residence. It is not appropriate to choose a low value and then assign my client a lien at the time in real dollar terms. As Malmquist says, and you've already brought up Malmquist, if you're going to do something like that, allow somebody to continue. May I continue my point?
You may finish, yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you can allow somebody to live in the house and get the value of it and put off into the future some reckoning that will be, quote, equal under the law, you got a couple choices. Or you could have ordered a buyout. You could have forced a sale, which is what the district court did involving some of the motorcycles and other vehicles. You're going to sell this. You're going to split the proceeds. Here it said, well, it's hard to turn real property into cash. No, it isn't. Happens all the time, every single day. Or you could have a combination. Make them put it on the market. If it doesn't sell within 12 or 18 months, then we'll go to Plan B. Plan C here was to enter a flat lien amount that is essentially unchanging forever, regardless of how long it takes, foreclosable under a checklist of future events that may never occur in their lifetime and without appropriate checks for when, in fact, they may occur. So this property, which is very desirable. It's 5 acres, bounded by BLM land, so it's got predictable land use. This is a valuable piece of property. It could be worth $500,000 in 10 years. Or, you know, we don't know. But under this decree, unfairly, my client is told that it's equal, that he shall have a lien in the amount of one half of what appears to be a fairly arbitrarily chosen value. That is not what Malmquist teaches, which is you must build in something about future value if you're going to do it this way. And if you can't do that, don't do it this way.
Are you saying he's never going to be paid on that? But if it's many years in the future, what he is paid will be greatly discounted because the value will have increased?
Both are equally likely and equally unfair.
So is there no mechanism for him to be paid? Like you said, the normal is a buyout or a sale within some time period.
Not in the four corners of the order, no.
Was that issue raised in front of the district court?
I don't know whether Mr. Fisher on his own was able to raise that.
Okay, so what do you suggest we do with that?
Well, it is patently unfair for it to exist as it is. And so, you know, if a pro se litigant who clearly expressed dissatisfaction with the valuation and the disposition is perhaps not able to say it in the way that I would as his advocate in that court, the court should probably look favorably upon, given all the other errors here, look favorably upon a remand with instructions. Because it's just not proper.
If he passed away before Ms. Wing, then what would happen then to this lien?
Whatever his estate would escape to.
All right. Sorry to keep going.
Thank you very much. You. We'll see where we're at, and we'll perhaps give you a couple of minutes to respond.
That's fine. Thank you.
Ms. Ammons.
Good Good afternoon, and if it please the court. My name is Deborah Emmons. I'm representing Ms. Wing, the wife, plaintiff, respondent, and cross-appellant in this matter. This is a divorce action that started very messy with the appellant being arrested and removed from the marital home. As opposing counsel indicated, there are key things that they've argued in their opening brief. One is in regards to the separate property. The court actually did a very big job in terms of dividing separate property. If you'll remember, Mr. Fisher had a business that was deemed to be his separate property and allocated the debts that were associated with that separate property to Mr. Fisher. My client, there was another business. She operated it primarily, Little B's Hardware, which at the time was kind of a joint venture between the two parties. They agreed that that would be considered separate property, and the court, through the evidence that was provided, assigned debt over to my client as well. And it should be noted that that debt that was assigned between the two was basically the same, about $50,000.
Ms. Ammons, did that business sell any trinkets?
No, Your Honor. It,
know where the district court came up with that term?
I do not know. That was kind of a surprise in the amended. We agree that the amended decree has some significant errors. For example, my client has never been an addict. She was recovering from back surgery. So there are errors in that, but we would also contend that on the major issues that are here, the court really laid out its thinking in terms of alimony, attorney fees, and all of those things.
What's the error on the alimony? Is it the 6 months or the 5 years? Is that what you're concerned about?
Your Honor, in the very end of that order, which I consider the actual order, not just the findings area, he indicates it's $1,200 for 5 years. So it does say in the findings area a 6 months. So that is an error, but I think the fact that it's over in the order section makes it somewhat clear. We are trying to avoid a remand, and we're trying to avoid this remand because otherwise I have that feeling that we're going to be back here in a year.
Hey, what about Mr. Schrager's point that if there were any errors that require a remand, other things have to be looked at again because the financial picture shifts?
Your Honor.
In the alimony and the attorney fees.
Yes, Your Honor. He's somewhat right in terms of if you move one thing, the other thing changes. But I think what has happened here is decisions in terms of the alimony were based on the evidence. Decisions in regards to even the characterization of the New York Life retirement account was based on the evidence that was presented. So in that particular case, there was evidence that was presented and statements made by Mr. Fisher that it was his separate property. That was certainly his opinion. New York Life, the way they approach all of these life insurance policies and this retirement account is they allow their clients or their customers to use it as a bank, if you will. So when he was needing to pay a loan, he'd use one account and then pay himself the interest when he was returning, paying off that loan. There was the court found that there was significant amount of commingling. And even in his own testimony, Mr. Fisher admitted that he was using this New York Life account, 2955, to pay off another loan that was out on one of the other life insurance policies.
It sounds like Mr. Schrager almost conceded that the life insurance arguments aren't going anywhere. And he's focusing entirely on the IRA, which he says was premarital and no other funds were put into it, and therefore it's separate property by nature of documentation. It doesn't require even any testimony.
Your Honor, he testified that he was using the funds in that retirement account to pay off another and his words in testimony were a community property asset. He was paying the $303 so that the community would benefit.
Where in the record is that? Do you have a citation for us?
I do. Hold on.
That's from the IRA that you're talking about, not from the life insurance?
That 303, at the time of the trial, he had started paying the 303 from that account. Previously, it had been paid by both parties, and Mr. Fisher started paying it out of this particular account.
Hold on, I didn't know you could take a loan against an IRA. I know you can do it against an insurance policy, but an IRA, you can take a loan?
Well, evidence was submitted showing that the $303 was coming out from his 2955 that was going into the retirement account, or going into the New York, the life insurance account.
So you're saying that he took the 303 out of the IRA account to pay for the life insurance account? But is there any evidence, and I think Judge Westbrook asked the question in the record, if there's a citation that we could have to show that the community funds were actually paid into the IRA account, or any reference to show that they were paid out of the IRA account into the life insurance policy?
Well, one of our contentions is once you have found evidence of commingling, that it then becomes the party that is claiming it's separate property to show that he maintained that as a separate account.
But I'm just talking about the IRA, not the life insurance. Let's assume that Mr. Fisher could take money out of the IRA to make the monthly payments on the life insurance policy. Let's assume that that's what he could do. But how does that change the IRA that was a separate property, because I think it was purchased in 2007, is that right, thereabouts?
Yes.
Prior to marriage. So it's a separate property. How can we see where there is commingling of marital assets into the IRA? Not payment out of the IRA, but commingling into the IRA. I mean, I'm not certain I'm following.
Yes. Well,
that argument.
When he started it was $27,000 in terms of the value of that IRA. At one point prior to the start of the divorce, about 6 months prior, it had a value of $147,000, and then at the time discovery started, it had been brought down to $107,000. The court found that he had been commingling these funds. And he primarily was the only one that had access to any of these New York Life accounts. And
you say commingling, you're saying he took money out of the New York Life policies and put them into the IRA?
In some cases, and then paid himself back from those other loans.
Weren't those insurance policies separate? They were premarital?
There was one that was separate, and then a number of them that had started after the marriage, including
right, so,
the one, and he admitted.
After the marriage, different situation, but before the marriage, it would be separate. It would stay separate property. Then you're back to this Momquist question of if the community is entitled to some reimbursement, if the community helped that separate property advance.
And the community was paying these premiums all the way through.
Right, but isn't that different than just dividing it 50-50? It's not community property. It's separate property that grows. And so the community is entitled to make a claim, but not to necessarily claim half of it as like community property.
I'm not in disagreement that there might have needed to be a Momquist equation in regards to that. But I think the way the court found was, since there was commingling and there was nothing that was provided, and really Mr. Fisher had multiple opportunities and to provide tracing of where things were. It was us that actually went and subpoenaed the New York Life records, so the court had something to deal with. He completely didn't meet his burden. The court said that then what was in front of him was presumptively community property and divided it equally.
Did you have anything more to add about where in the record this is?
One second. So in the record at ROA 1789 and 90 is evidence that the 303 was going from 2955, the variable annuity account, into the life insurance policy. And at, I'm sorry, I'm not putting my hands on, it was the first hearing where Mr. Fisher had indicated that what he actually testified to the same thing that document shows.
So I have a question about Mr. Schrager's statement during his initial argument that there was a premium payment option for a separate account in the amount of $303, but it was a different account. He said that was in the record at page 1474. How do you respond to that argument?
It was going into a separate account. It was a community property account. His testimony is at the second transcript, 429 and 430 were the numbers. It was a separate account. It was ending in 4623, and that was at that 1789/90 reference.
Ms. Namens, I have to ask you about the attorney fees. You have indicated in your petition below for reconsideration and on appeal that attorney fees that Mr. Fisher paid were community funds and your client should get half of it.
Yes.
Were the attorney fees that your client paid from community funds or separate funds?
She testified that she had received loans from her mother and she had not claimed any of those loans as being community property. They were separate funds.
So all of the attorney fees that she paid were separate?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't see that in the papers, but it could have been in the testimony.
Yes, Your Honor. It was provided to the court.
So do you know what happened that changed the amount awarded of attorney fees from the original decree to the amended decree, essentially cut it in half? Is there any explanation for that?
No, Your Honor. I think that was clear error. If you look at what the court said in the amended decree, he got confused in terms of even who Mr. Fisher's attorney was, saying that I had been representing him and that my fee was $1,250 and that we had shown that the whole amount that we brought forward was then appropriate to be put on Mr. Fisher. So we contend that was error, that the $37,000 that was asked for, and he even indicates that, you know, in terms of the affidavit, the Brunel factors, he goes through all of that, indicates that was warranted in this particular case.
All right. So what if it's not marital waste? Can the court still award the full amount? And when the court changed it, is there something that would prohibit the court from changing it and when it amended the decree? Because normally, you know, until you have the final document, in this case the amended decree, it may not be final.
But his analysis is in the amended decree, and then he changes the amount right at the end. He says that the $37,000 was appropriate. Now, that wasn't marital waste. That was under an award of attorney fees. So he then just changed that number to $12,500, and I think that was clearly just error.
Okay, so in terms of a remand, wouldn't you at least want a remand on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know how else you do it. I'm just concerned. There has been so much litigation, so many frivolous filings here. My client, her fees are over $60,000 currently. So
let me just clarify to make certain that I'm understanding this. The marital waste was accounted for in the lien on the marital property. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And is it conceivable because the alimony was incorrect in the findings versus the order that maybe the attorney fees were in the same situation or?
Potentially.
Or did he act, did the district court actually indicate a reason, even if it didn't make it into the amended order or the amended decree, any reason for reducing the fees that were awarded to Ms. Wing?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Thank you.
And it says I'm out of time.
Oh, I cut off Judge Westbrook. I'm very sorry about that.
Oh, no, I'm fine.
Okay. Well, I think because of the situation, I'm going to, if the appellant would like to respond for 3 minutes, and then I would give you an additional 3 minutes to respond.
Thank you.
Your Honor, you were very gracious to allow me to run as far over as I did. I think I've made all the points that I feel are necessary today, and we will submit on those.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ammons, if you have anything else to add, feel free.
Thank you.
In regards to something opposing counsel had brought up, the value of the marital home that the court used was the higher value that had been presented by Mr. Fisher. So we had a CMA. It was done by a realtor in the area. She initially had the $145,000 given to it. She reduced that upon a second CMA when she actually went into the house and saw the errors and so forth. So we had proposed a lower amount. So the amount that was provided and used was Mr. Fisher's amount, and it should be noted, opposing counsel says it's valuable property. It's a geodesic dome in Smoky Valley, and prior to them actually purchasing it, it had been on the market for over 20 years. That was the type of situation that Judge Shirley was dealing with. It's very hard to move a piece of property that way. My client had expressed an interest in staying there, and I believe that's why it was set up that way.
Was there ever an argument below that it wasn't appropriate to choose a low value and assign a lien, that there should have been some sort of future value built in, as counsel indicated?
No, Your Honor. I think that the court was trying to divide it at the time, the value at the time of the divorce. And so even going forward, my client was responsible for the rest of the mortgage payments, and so any increase in value would have gone to her.
Right. I mean, doesn't COGOD say you value it at the time of the divorce decree?
Exactly. So,
is there any ending date? How will his lien be satisfied?
Well, Your Honor, a lot of these discussions in regards to attorney fees and so forth, that may end up being kind of how it ends up getting paid off to Mr. Fisher. Again, these parties don't have a lot of money. I indicated how much she has spent in attorney fees. I know there's NRAP 38 out there that, you know, he should be on notice. I know counsel was appointed to him. He was filing things multiple times every week that my client, that we had to respond to and try and defend. So I would also ask this court to put him on notice that attorney fees may be appropriate for the appeal.
Any further questions?
No.
Thank you very much. Thank